Afternoon and welcome. The House Transportation Policy and Regional Governance Committee will come to order. Would like to welcome all the new members to this new committee. So I think we're going to have an interesting session for sure. Quorum, we don't have to worry about today. We don't have any minutes that we're going to look at. So I would like to, though, you'll find a few things in your packet. Of course, the rules is the first thing. And then secondly, we have several presentations, overviews, background, so that everybody gets onto the same page. I think we have a number of freshmen. So our goal there is to make sure everybody has some working knowledge of this area of transportation. And we'll be getting to that in a moment. But why don't we first, I'd like to first go and do some introductions of members so we know who we are, where we're coming from. You don't have to go into your, some of us I know were in the One Minnesota conference last Wednesday. So you don't have to tell us your political journey, but anyway, maybe we'll find that out someday. Representative Hornsey, why don't you start over there, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Congratulations on your new position. I'm Frank Hornstein. I represent District 61A, which is parts of downtown and southwest Minneapolis. And I've served, I think, every time we've had a transportation policy committee. I've been on the committee since I first was elected in 2002, and I also did serve on the Metropolitan Council from 2000 to 2002.
Ah, new bit of information. Thank you, Representative Hortzi.
Cheryl Yuwaki, represent Hopkins in St. Louis Park, and this is my second term. Excited to be on transportation policy. Haven't been on it before, so thank you.
I'm Erin Cagle. I represent District 37A, which is Blaine, Coon Rapids, Spring Lake Park.
Thank you, and you're a freshman.
I am.
Happy to have you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, I'm also a freshman. My name is Andrew Carlson. Members, Andrew Carlson from District 50B in Bloomington.
Thank you, Representative Carlson.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Connie Bernardi, and I represent the communities of Fridley, New Brighton, and Spring Lake Park. I have served in the legislature. This will be my sixth term, and I am the lead DFL on this committee.
Oh, great. Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Okay, we'll go over here.
Hello, I'm John Kosnick from Lakeville. Honored to be serving as your vice chair, and I am also on the finance side of the transportation. And this is my second go-around on transportation in my second term.
Thank you.
John Petersburg from Otonawasika area.
That's okay.
You missed.
I'm hiding in the corner. I thought I actually had two mics and was really excited about that, too. So I'm Regina Barr, and I'm from Invergrove Heights, and I represent the communities of Invergrove, Sunfish Lake, parts of Mendota Heights, and Eagan.
Cal Barr, 31B, Anoka, all Anoka County. Everything's inside Anoka County, East Bethlehem Lake, Linwood, and Columbus.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Joe McDonald from the city of Delano, County of Wright, just in my fourth term now.
You're getting time long in the tooth, Representative.
I am, and gray here.
Thank you.
I'm Nolan West. I am also a freshman, except I was also here a little bit. Representative Joaquin would probably be the only one who recognized me from that side of the table. But I represent District 37B, which is most of Blaine, basically everything Representative Cagle does not represent.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Jerry Hertaus, serving third term, representing 33A, which is the western one-third of Hennepin County, Wayzata, Orono, Minnetrista, St. Bonnie, and north up through Medina, Maple Plain, Long Lake, Greenfield, Corcoran, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of places, 11 cities, 8 school districts. They all like a piece of me. All right. And welcome, freshmen. I think you'll find the committee work entertaining as well as very rewarding. Thank you.
And Representative Mason over there.
I'm Sandra Mason. I represent 51A, which is most of Eagan, west of 35E, all of northern Burnsville, and I've been on transportation for quite a while, and it started when I was on the city council because I served on the board for the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority.
Wow.
So transit is also very important.
Thank you.
Part of transportation.
Great, thank you. And I think I failed to introduce myself. And so Linda Runbeck, representative from 38A, and my district is wedged on either side by 35W and 35E. So I'm bordered by those two. And this is my fourth term, I think, on transportation, but I'll double check that one. Maybe it's third. So, and we have staff we should introduce as well. So why don't we start over here on my left?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Andrew Lee from the House Fiscal Office, nonpartisan office.
Things do that around here, don't they?
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Deb Dyson from House Research.
And Madam Chair and members, I'm Matt Burris, also from House Research.
Very good.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Alex Poy. I'm the committee legislative assistant.
Mm-hmm. Jenny Nash, DFL Research.
Great.
I'm Abby Loesch. I'm the committee administrator.
Ryan Carroll, GOP Research.
Very good. And we have a page. And why don't you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Sean Reibel. This is my second program, so I recognize most of people in the room.
Right. Great. Thank you. Okay. We do want to just have a moment of discussion about the committee rules. What you're seeing is a tiny, tiny revision, but thank you to Representative Bernardi for bringing it to our attention. So what you see now is that when it comes to amendments, we will be accepting emailed only amendments. The original draft said written or emailed, and as she pointed out, that's kind of confusing. And in this day and age, there's probably very little need for having written communication on things such as this. So that is how we will be doing it. Representative.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Would you like to take suggestions on other things I just caught this morning?
Well, we can.
Okay.
Do you have some other comments?
Well, and it'd be fine with me if you intentionally did that. I just want to make sure that you did. But on number two, when it says we meet on Monday, and where it states we meet on Monday and Wednesdays from 1 to 2:30, is that your intention? I believe we have space until 2:45 possibly. So I just wanted to clarify what your intention is there.
Representative Wright, we are going officially till 2:45. Yeah, so I suppose that's an old form from somewhere. Okay, so we'll make note of that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, very good. All right, we're going to proceed then with our overviews. So if Mr. Burris, all of you three at the same time up there? Or? Okay, Mr. Burris and Ms. Dyson. And I think if you don't know these folks already, you're going to come to know them. They're really very terrific assets and so important to our committee process. So we appreciate you very much. And we're starting with Mr. Burris then, is that correct? Great.
Madam Chair and members, again, my name is Matt Burris with House Research. And together with Ms. Dyson and Mr. Lee, we were asked to provide some background and overview information on transportation policy and regional governance. With that, we'll start in with a little bit of high-level comments and presentation on the transportation system, beginning with the roads side of the ledger. So there is a system of street and highways that's something parallel to kind of capillaries and the blood system. So they're kind of the major arteries and a connection to smaller streets. So the large side, or kind of more major end of it, is the state's highway system, which is a combination of various types of trunk highways. So trunk highway is kind of the broad category of roads that are under the jurisdiction of the state through the Minnesota Department of Transportation, MnDOT. And that includes the interstate highways and U.S. highways and other trunk highways. And then connecting up to that are various other road systems of local units of government. really counties, cities, and townships. And each of those units of government have a set of roads that are under their respective road jurisdictions. So it's a combination of road systems, highways, and municipal streets that each have separate jurisdictions. We won't be delving in this presentation very far into the finance side of highways, but just so that you're aware that the local road system is actually divided up further into county roads and city streets, for which a portion of the major transportation funding streets are dedicated, and this is called the state aid system. So there are county state aid highways and municipal state aid streets, and that those form part of the county and city systems. And there's a constitutional framework that underpins all of that. That's where the state aid concept is housed. Shifting just briefly over to transit, transit is provided at the local level, and there are a number of transit providers and operators throughout the state. In the metro area here in the Twin Cities, the Metropolitan Council is the largest of the transit operators. There are also transit service provided by the opt-outs, as they're called, suburban transit providers, as well as some independent providers such as the University of Minnesota. There's a wide amount of variety of transit service throughout greater Minnesota, and they're classified largely based on the urban versus rural type population and centers and where the service is provided. But the variation also extends across what kind of unit of government provides the service. So there's city, there's county, there's multi-jurisdictional, and there's a good deal of variety as well as to the kind of service that's provided as far as routes, demand response, some route deviation, having a fixed schedule as opposed to a little bit more of a dynamic or more limited schedule. That's a number of systems throughout the state. Also regarding transit, there are a number of different entities that are involved in the public sphere. The state is one of the funders in the sense of the state legislature providing and allocating various state revenues. In the Twin Cities metro area, the Metropolitan Council, as I had mentioned, is one of the transit operators. The council also provides a variety of other functions that we'll be providing some intro into a little bit later. The Minnesota Department of Transportation is one of the state agencies and is the aid distributor for transit throughout greater Minnesota. Transit is also relevant to counties, to regional railroad authorities, and also joint powers organizations, so counties or other local units of government operating under an agreement. The County's Transit Improvement Board, we'll be talking about it a bit later, is an example of that. Cities could be transit providers, as I've mentioned, suburban transit providers or opt-outs, private contractors, and then the U.S. Department of Transportation through a couple of different federal agencies are also involved entities in various functions. Just as a quick comment, there are other modes, as they're referred to in the transportation world, and that extends from the various airports in the aeronautics system that are a variety of different structures, ports, bicycle and pedestrian, which is commonly referred to as active transportation, or is kind of the term that's come about, I think, in the last couple of years. And then railroads, so that's more the private side as opposed to publicly owned airports. With that, I'll move into touching on a few of the general committee areas, issue areas, largely by highlighting some examples and kind of hopefully give you a sense of the overall purview that historically has been what transportation policy committees have looked at. And this is intended as kind of a brief and high-level set of comments on the kinds of topics, depending on what sorts of bills are introduced or what kind of interest the committee or the chair have in delving into further. So one, kind of thematically, one area is in agency operations, and I mean that fairly broadly, covering everything from the high-level mission and the overall structure of state agencies to specific programs, how the agency goes about administering and pursuing its legislative direction. In transportation, there are a couple of departments and entities that are most often dealt with. MnDOT I had mentioned already, so MnDOT is the maintainer, constructor of the state's trunk highway system, but is also involved with statewide planning and non-trunk highway activities ranging from Greater Minnesota Transit to freight operations. The Department of Public Safety has a number of divisions within it. Some of them deal with transportation more specifically. There's an office for pipeline safety. There's also an office or a division that handles both driver licensing and more motor vehicle registration. We'll be talking a bit about that further. The Metropolitan Council had been mentioned. And I see here's my first instance of an acronym without having, or maybe a couple of acronyms without having written it out, but the Metropolitan Airports Commission is the MAC. That's one of the regional entities here in the Twin Cities that we'll also be touching on. And then the local units of government, in the context of transportation, most often means counties and cities and towns as road authorities. There are certainly other operations of local units of government, but from the transportation perspective, that's probably their functions that come up the most. And I mentioned administration and just a wide variety of aspects of how departments operate, policies and decision making are a couple other examples. One area that has come up a fair amount in transportation policy is the planning and project development process. And this applies to highways as well as transit, and in particular transitways. The project selection process is large scale and can be pretty complex. What's referred to as programming or programmed projects, what they're really talking about is projects that have been selected to do some construction work around on a future capital investment schedule. So there are various aspects to the construction side and the maintenance side that have fallen into legislative interest. Another area that that comes up is with respect to the jurisdiction. So I mentioned that MnDOT has jurisdiction over the trunk highway system. Counties and cities and townships have jurisdiction over their respective roads, and sometimes they're turnbacks and changing jurisdictions of specific routes, kind of move from being a trunk highway to, say, becoming a county to better align what the nature of that roadway system is. There are a variety of, as you might imagine, legislative reports that come out of the legislative process, and sometimes those are specific to what an agency has undertaken, what it plans to undertake, or kind of broader policy topics that a department like MnDOT or the Department of Public Safety might be asked to look further into and report back to the legislature on. Sometimes legislative reports are in the context of a bill that had moved through the process and ultimately the legislature decided wants to seek further background or in-depth information before developing new policies around that area or modifying policies around that issue area. So a couple other the policy topic areas are starting with motor vehicles. This refers to a couple of different things on the motor vehicle side. Vehicles are registered, titled, and carry plates under state law requirements. There are a couple of different kinds of license plates. There's a standard one, but then there are specialty plates, and those are authorized through statute. So one of the regular kinds of bills that's typically introduced each legislative biennium involves authorizing a new or modifying an existing type of special plate. Motor vehicle administration is done by the division I mentioned, Driver and Vehicle Services in the Department of Public Safety. And the system behind that is actually a hybrid between public and private entities. So kind of the general oversight is at the Department of Public Safety level, but there are a number of deputy registrars that are can either be private companies or public units of government or designated. So a city might provide deputy registrar services. And part of the context or concept behind this is to provide a widespread set of offices for people to physically go into throughout the state rather than it being centralized just in St. Paul. Driver licensing is the kind of the other side of the driver and vehicle services equation, if you will. The state issues driver's licenses and regulates driving. There are also identification cards. One of the issues that has come up in the last couple of years is the Real ID Act of 2005. And that's actually a bill that might be, there's a bill on that might be headed to this committee in the next few days, as I understand it. This is a federal law that is centered around requirements for state-issued driver's licenses and identification cards, and sets up a series of requirements on verification of identity and presence in the United States. And one of the aspects of that is a federal phased enforcement of when the various federal agencies will accept state-issued licenses and identification cards. Graduated driver's licensing is another policy topic that comes up on occasion in transportation policy, and this is a system of providing driving privilege through a sort of phased set of privileges to new drivers. So the idea is, kind of policy goal is to create some limits on new drivers and then expand those as drivers develop experience and become more comfortable. There have been a couple of modifications in the past 10 years or so to the graduated driver's licensing system. Driver education is another example, and that's again kind of part of the overall administrative structure for driver and vehicle services. I mentioned the public-private system for deputy registrars, so motor vehicle registration and titling. There's essentially the same system for what are called driver's license agents, and it's for the most part the same set of offices providing similar services throughout the state for driver licensing. There's some variation in the specific office and the scope of powers or services that a given office provides, but the basic structure is about the same. Another general area of transportation policy is in traffic regulation and driver safety. And this includes classifying various types of vehicles, establishing vehicle equipment requirements, so when lights, what kind of lights a vehicle has to have, for example, or whether or under what circumstances a white light can be displayed to the rear. As you might imagine, there's a wide range of detail behind this. At a high level, state law lays out various types of vehicle types, and then establishes requirements for equipment. Similarly, there are a number of different driving rules. So speed limits is one example. There's a set of default speed limits that are set in state law, and some circumstances when local units of government are authorized to modify those speed limits or seek a modification, which is through the Department of Transportation. Cell phones, texting, and distracted driving have been a topic of legislative interest in recent years. A couple other areas are towing, enforcement of traffic laws. So on the state system, that's the state patrol. Local system, that's local law enforcement. There are various penalties that go along with the violations, from driving violations or vehicle violations. A number of those are at the lowest of the penalty level, which is a petty misdemeanor, but there are some more stringent or higher penalties for violations. Vehicle transportation is another area that has traditionally been part of the purview of the policy committee. There's a fairly intricate regulatory structure for transporting pupils, and that covers the drivers, the classifying and identifying the vehicles, standards around those vehicles, training, inspections, crackdown checks, and so forth. And the entity that oversees pupil transportation and performs inspections of school buses and so forth is housed within the State Patrol. The State Patrol, by the way, is another division within the Department of Public Safety. You're thinking in org chart terms. Another rather large area is commercial vehicle regulation. And there's a large body of federal law that addresses interstate, so cross-state regulations. The intrastate or within the state of Minnesota regulations are parallel for quite a bit of the regulatory structure is incorporated so that the state laws match what's established federally, but there are various exceptions. And you can see the list here, some of the areas that are covered under this regulatory scheme. Registration and a lot of the motor carrier oversight is through MnDOT, but in the street enforcement, if you will, is through law enforcement agencies. One of the issues that has come up with some regularity is on truck size and weight regulations. In state law, there are a number of different types of regulations around truck sizes and weights. There are limits on dimensions, so width and length, and then there's a set of basic weight limits for trucks and larger commercial vehicles. And it's something of a complex scheme to it, but there's the gross vehicle weight, the total weight, but then there are a bunch of other weights based on axles and axle groupings. There are also adjustments to some of those weights for certain types of vehicles, as well as special permits typically for hauling specific materials. And it's that special permits area that has most often seen some legislative activity in the past few years. Rail safety and preparedness is another area that has been a topic of legislative interest in recent years. One safety issue centers around when a railroad crosses a street, and the interaction or potential interaction between the rail cars and motor vehicles. So rail crossings and grade separation is one of the topics that's come up. As you might imagine, oil and other hazardous materials and safety around the transport by rail of crude and other materials has been another area of legislative interest. So along those lines, both the emergency and environmental responses and preparedness and training issues have been legislative topics on that. To wrap up some of these themes and examples, this slide has a list of some of the areas that have historically overlapped somewhat between transportation policy and other committees. Just to highlight a couple of the examples here, the Public Safety Committee has traditionally had a high degree of interest in penalty increases and penalties that carry jail time. And there are some instances, as I've mentioned, of higher penalties for, say, traffic violations. So that might be an example of a bill in that area that would move through both sets of committees. Pupil transportation is another one where, just looking at it from historical terms of the education and transportation policy committees, there's been some overlap or shared committee interest in that topic.
Very good. Thanks, Mr. Burris.
Madam Chair and members, again, my name is Deb Dyson with House Research Department, and I'm going to do a high-level overview of regional governance. And the three entities that I wanted to talk about are the Airports Commission, very briefly, Mosquito Control District, very briefly, and then the Met Council, which generates the most interest among members. The starting with the Airports Commission, it was established in 1943, and before that, the Lowell Chamberlain Field was owned by the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and they had issued the debt. The legislature decided to combine and create a regional agency that to own and operate the airport, and at this point, the Airports Commission owns and operates the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport and the six reliever airports, which are St. Paul, Lake Elmo, Flying Cloud, which is out in Eden Prairie, the Crystal Airport, Anoka County Blaine, and the Air Lake in Lakeville. There are a couple of other airports in the metropolitan area, the South St. Paul Municipal Airport, and then I think there's one or two others that I don't know the names of. It's governed by a 15-member board. Eight are from districts that are combinations of the Met Council districts, so based on that. Four are from Greater Minnesota, and that goes back to, in part, to the Northwest Airlines financing back in the early 90s, and also looking at the location for a potential new airport, which the legislature decided not to pursue back in 96. There are also the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul or their representatives that serve on the Airports Commission, and then the chair, and they all serve four-year staggered terms, not the mayors, but the others. The jurisdiction of the Airports Commission is kind of a funny one. It's a metropolitan area, but it also says in statute that it's 35 miles from City Hall, so you have two circles that kind of overlap, and then the metropolitan area. But that's the jurisdiction of the Airports Commission.
So, Ms. Dyson, just a moment then. So it goes out, that jurisdiction goes as far as Wright and Isanti and south to?
I don't know, how far out 35 miles is now, Chair. Sorry. I didn't think to look that part up.
Yeah.
Thank you.
For the Airports Commission, they have levy authority. They have bonding authority. The Airports Commission has not levied since 1969, but it does have that authority if needed. Its financing is user fees, so the landing fees for the airlines, concessions, rents, parking, and then for capital projects, there are federal grants. The 2017 budget, just to give you a number, is an overall $353 million. Some of that it's broken down. In their budget, they break it out by operating, non-operating, and then net revenues available for designation. But if you wanted more about the MAX airport, that would be a whole other, or the MAX budget and the airports, that would be another presentation. Just to tie this into regional governance, airports and the aviation system are part of the regional transportation system plan that the Met Council is required to adopt. And so the MAC and the Met Council work with each other on developing the aviation and airports component of the Metropolitan Development Guide and the transportation system plan. There's also a review component by the Met Council of certain capital projects by the MAC over certain dollar amounts. And then moving on quickly and very briefly to the Mosquito Control Commission, this has not really been of any particular interest to legislators for quite a while, but every now and then certain agencies or topics do become very controversial. So I thought I would just mention that there is this joint, it's a statutory joint powers board with 18 members. It was originally established as a joint powers board in 1958 and then codified as a special taxing district in 1959. Its budget is entirely property tax based, and in 2017 it's for $18.8 million. And its mission is fairly straightforward, controlling mosquitoes, disease vectoring ticks, and black gnats in the metropolitan area. As I mentioned, it has 18 members, three county commissioners each from Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, and Ramsey counties, and then two county commissioners each from Carver, Scott, and Washington. And it was modified, that membership was modified a couple of years ago to add a commissioner, and I think it was either Carver or Scott County, but the changes in the governance structure have been generated by the counties over time. And just so you know, this is not technically a metropolitan agency, even though it's in the metropolitan government chapter, but there is a definition of metropolitan agency which is limited at this point to the Parks and Open Space Commission and the Metropolitan Airports Commission.
Ms. Dyson, if we could pause, I think we have a question. Yeah. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Dyson, question regarding the tax levy from the property tax, does that include the commercial and industrial property tax in those districts as well, or just the residential?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, I assume that it covers whatever is levied. I don't know the tax system. I can find out for you, but I assume that it would cover the commercial industrial.
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, and in that case, I would be interested in finding out if that was the case. And then I would presume then at that point it would be just in that taxing district with the commercial industrial, not the outstate or other districts that are not in that metropolitan, correct?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, that's right. It's a statutory special taxing district, so its authority to levy is only within the geographic area of the district. It would not be anywhere else. There's in Chapter 17 or 18 of Minnesota statutes, there are provisions for establishing mosquito control programs and districts in other parts of the state. This is the metropolitan one, and it's the only one that of mosquito control that's a special taxing district. But I can get back to you about the levy for that. But I know it's a property tax levy. I assume it's on whatever is taxable, but I'll make a note.
Very good. Thank you.
And then going to the Metropolitan Council, which is this is the big one that everybody has a lot of interest in. It's, as it says here, it was created in 1967 by state statute, but some people go back to, I kind of like looking at things in historical perspective, but some people will think about regional government going back all the way to 1933 when Minneapolis and St. Paul created a joint powers entity to acquire and build sanitary sewer district facilities, and that was to deal with sewage. And in many ways, that those facilities were the ones that were ultimately acquired by the Metropolitan Council in 69, when the Metropolitan Waste Control Commission was established. But it's that need for regional handling of certain infrastructure to so that people can live next to each other. So 1967 was the official creation of the Metropolitan Council. It was, among other things, it acquired the planning functions of the previous planning commission that was established in 1957 that was had no real authority but was told to plan, and it had 28 members
Those functions were then transferred to the new Met Council. The Met Council has 16 members from districts. The districts are based on population, so it is redistricted every 10 years after the federal decennial census. From 1967 to 1994, the terms were staggered terms. At one point, they were six-year terms, then they were four-year terms, but they were staggered fixed terms. In 1994, with a major reorganization of metropolitan government, they were turned into all members of the Met Council being appointed by the governor to serve at the pleasure of the governor. The chair is appointed from the region at large. The region that the Met Council has jurisdiction over includes the seven metropolitan counties, Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington. And over time, the cities that are on the border counties that have grown into the metropolitan area, they have been excluded from the jurisdiction of the Metropolitan Council because they originated outside of the seven-county area. So in Dakota County, Northfield is excluded. And then Hanover and Rockford are excluded from the Hennepin County area. New Prague is excluded from Scott County. And then last session, Representative Tim Kelly had a bill that would have excluded Cannon Falls that was heard in the Government Operations Committee, but because Cannon Falls is growing into Dakota County, but the bill was not enacted. So it may come back. I don't know. Within the metropolitan area, you have 181 cities and towns and other special districts, watershed districts, watershed management areas. The population, 55% of the state's population is in the seven-county metropolitan area. The estimated population in 2015 was almost 3 million people. You have pretty big differences between the counties. Hennepin County is over a million population. And then you have Harvard County with about 98,000 people. So you have some pretty big differences in the counties and the type of population and density of development that you're dealing with. Looking at the council in a different way, it's unique in the country in that it is established by state law as a regional agency, but it's a political subdivision of the state, but it's run by appointees of the governor. In other parts of the country, you have Council of Governments, COGS. One example is Denver that has a COG that was created back in the 50s, and it's a nonprofit voluntary association of local governments, nine counties and 45 cities and towns. Again, in the Denver area, they're dealing with over half the state's population within their COG. They do regional planning, specifically the transportation planning. They are do advocacy related to area agency on aging and probably some other functions, but it's a really different kind of governance structure for a region. And then you have something like in some areas of the country in the past, they've taken a regional approach by merging the city and towns, Miami and Dade County down in Florida. Indianapolis and Marion County in Indiana are the most recent ones, but you can go back over a century and you have Philadelphia and Philadelphia County that created regional entities. Portland is another outlier in how it's structured, and you'll often hear the Met Council and Portland compared. And Portland is a home rule charter regional government with directly elected members, six members, and then a chair, regional executive elected at large. They have a regional auditor. It's a smaller population. You're talking about 1.6 million roughly, and three counties, 24 cities, no towns. But they also have different functions. Portland Metro handles solid waste and garbage. They own and operate the zoo, a convention center. They do land use planning and set the regional urban growth boundaries in that area. But it is a separate entity that was established back in the 60s that owns and operates the transit system. So no matter what area of the country you go to, there's going to be some difference in how things are structured and then what are the powers and duties. And that's often what comes back to the discussion at the legislature whenever discussing regional government. It's like, what are the powers and duties that you want the entity to do, and what governance structure supports that the best? And that was true in 1967 with the discussion of what should this new regional entity be. Should it be a body that should be elected? And the people who are advocating an elected regional government were also looking at it as an operating entity, operating the transit and the wastewater systems. And those who wanted it to be appointed and be planning only. And so there's always the tying in of what are the functions and what's the best governance structure.
Ms. Dyson, if we could then, we've got a question here, Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give, you had mentioned that in 1994 there was a major restructure. Could you give the committee a little bit of background about that?
I will.
Some context?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, if it's okay, I wanted to rattle through some of the other big changes that, and then I get to 94, and that really was the biggest change.
Ms. Dyson, if I could just interrupt very quickly, I learned just yesterday or a couple days ago that there is a COG in Rochester, and so that's the first I'd ever been aware that there might be a regional governance entity elsewhere in the state, but maybe we could hear more about that. Doesn't have to be now, but that was news. So, anyway, you may.
Yeah.
Are you aware of it? First of all, I guess maybe let's find out.
Madam Chair, and somebody mentioned it to me also yesterday.
Oh. Okay.
But I think there are cooperative ventures all over the state that are not established in state statute. Local governments do cooperate with each other, and
all right.
It's I didn't know specifically about the Rochester Olmsted County Area 1, and that might be interesting to look at.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good.
So, to sort of quickly run through some major milestones in Met Council's history, I mentioned the 67 creation of the council itself. In the same year, in 1967, the Metropolitan Transit Commission was established to take over the failing transit system at the time. One of the council's duties in statute in 1967 was to look at the problems of the region and figure out what are the recommendations that should be made, and first and foremost on that list was what to do about sewage treatment, collection and treatment. The most commonly told story is that there was a suburb north of Minneapolis that was dumping raw sewage into the river just north of Minneapolis's water intake, and that created a serious problem for the city of Minneapolis. And so it's what do you do to handle sewage on a regional basis? And the council was directed to figure that out and make some recommendations. They were also told to come back with a recommendation on a zoo, and that ultimately resulted in the creation of the Minnesota Zoo in Apple Valley. Not everything that they recommended was something that they wanted to take on, but they recommended how things might be developed. So in 1969, the legislature on that recommendation created the Metropolitan Waste Control Commission, originally known as the Sewer Board, and that acquired the old sewer system that had started in the 30s, and then Waste Control Commission, which had a board membership of 8 members and a chair, that acquired facilities, was directed to build facilities, and was given authority to require communities to connect to the regional system. And then you have, also in 69, there was actually a park board created then, but the legislation actually was passed, I believe, by the Senate after the time for enactment, and it never actually took effect. And it was 1974 when the Parks and Open Space Commission was actually enacted, and that is still a subordinate commission to the Met Council, providing advice on regional parks and open space. In 1974, you have the Metropolitan Housing and Redevelopment Act. And the Metro HRA was established at the request of the suburban communities who wanted a regional approach to handling the administration of the housing stuff. So it was an efficiency measure that those communities look for. Today, the Metro HRA is the administrator for 97 suburban communities and these approximately 6,500 housing vouchers, which are the Section 8 type vouchers for private rental housing subsidies. In 1975, and the only reason I mention this recodification is because when people look at the statutes, it looks like everything was enacted in 1975 because of the history at the bottom of the statute. It was a recodification. If you really want to know how far back some things go, you look at something a little bit further back. Then continuing on, 1976, a couple of things happened. The Metropolitan Significance Act. Metro significance is a review process, and it can be triggered. There are rules adopted by the council in Minnesota rules that handle this. It has not been used a great deal, but it allows the council, a community petition of residents, to request a review of major projects that might affect more than one community. And the most recent example of that was the Burnsville Amphitheater in 2000. Bloomington and Burnsville were somewhat at odds with each other over an amphitheater and potential noise or traffic or, you know, whatever the concern might have been. If the council accepts the review process, it can put the project on hold for up to 12 months. But my understanding is that, as I said, it has not been used very often. There have been, according to the Met Council's website, on the history of this, there have been 16 requests over time, which is not very many given the time that has been out there. Only four of those have actually been performed. And often what happens with major projects is that the legislature will step in. For example, all of the various stadiums, the Met Stadium site, the Metrodome, the Viking Stadium, the racetracks, both the Harness Track and the Canterbury Downs. In all of those cases, the legislature has stepped in and put into the enabling legislation that Metropolitan Significance Review is not available. And because the legislature is making the determination. So that's the way that happens. Land Planning Act is probably the next biggest thing that came about in 1976 when the legislature directed the council to put together the guidelines, but all local governments in the metropolitan area were then under a mandate to adopt local comprehensive plans that are consistent with Metropolitan Development Guide. And this initially local governments were doing it as a one-time thing. In 1995 it became every 10 years you got to go back and look at it and update your plans in conjunction with the council's review and updating of its major system plans and the development guide. 1984, over the years there's always been some tension between the Waste Control Commission and the Metropolitan Transit Commission, which were two subordinate agencies to the Met Council, but with independent governing bodies. And the legislature tried to deal with some of the tensions that were involved there in 1984 by creating the Regional Transit Board that had the authority to administer all the financing for transit and oversee the Metro Transit Commission. But the financing that would put money in for example, the opt-out communities and the other suburban transit providers that Mr. Burris mentioned earlier, that was a board of, five members. So you had then some layers. You had the Met Council doing the long-range planning, Regional Transit Board doing short-range, five-year planning and for capital improvements and operations, and also handling the grants and financing for the mid-range for the providers. And then you had the Transit Commission as the owner-operator of the biggest of the bus systems. In 1986, there were some additional changes to the Land Planning Act and to the policy plans to try and get greater coordination between these various agencies and their planning and make them talk with each other. And that changed again with the 94 reorganization. 1989 was the Met Council and the Airports Commission together were involved in the Metropolitan it was the State Advisory Council on Metropolitan Airport Planning, and that was a multi-year process to look at the capacity of the existing airport and the forecast for increase in operations and figure out if a new airport should be built, and if so, where, or expand the existing airport. It was called the dual track airport planning process. And as you might guess, the decision in that came out in 95, it was going to be done in 96, but in 95 the legislature stepped in and said, we're done. It's going to be an expansion of the existing airport. We're not building a new one. The location of the new one would have been in Dakota County. That had been whittled down from areas all around the metropolitan area. 1991, 92, 93 were very active years with metropolitan governance issues, with every year bills being introduced to make the elected council an elected body, to abolish the Metropolitan Council, to change its structure, or to study it. And each one of those bills could be passed out of a committee in a single night, with the committee saying, let's do all of those because we're not sure what to do. And in 1993, after a couple of years of that, the legislature set up an advisory council that met through the interim to look at metropolitan governance issues. And the recommendation of that advisory council that had had a lot of, well, I won't go into the membership of that, but it had its final recommendation was to get rid of the Regional Transit Board, get rid of the Metropolitan Transit Commission, get rid of the Waste Control Commission, merge all operations into the Metropolitan Council, and make the council the owner and operator of these major regional systems as well as the long-range planning, so that one agency would have both the authority and responsibility for long-range planning, mid-range planning, and operations, and that it would all be coordinated by one body. Part of that recommendation, by a very narrow margin of this advisory council, was to make it an elected body. And so the 94 legislation, and I, the one thing I want to back up on that I also wanted to mention, part of the trigger for that 93, setting up that advisory council and why that council met steadily and worked very hard on that, was in 1993, Metro Mobility had been reorganized, and during the legislative session had a major meltdown to the point where Metro Mobility, special transportation, wasn't called Metro Mobility so much at the time, riders were being stranded in the snow with nobody picking them up. And the governor at the time saw a crisis and called out the National Guard. The National Guard started operating these services, and the Regional Transit Board had just tried to institute a new contract with different providers, and it just wasn't working. The scheduling system wasn't working, and it had become a danger to the riders. That caught everybody's attention to see the National Guard operating special transportation services, and so the advisory council did come up with recommendations to make major changes and move all of these into the Metropolitan Council. And that was the 1994 legislation. The bill that would have made the body an elected body failed on a very tight vote, you know, one or two votes on the House floor in 94. There was a reconsideration. It's very dramatic when it's happening, you know. But the reconsideration of that bill came back with the changes a few days later, where instead of having staggered terms, this is when the change came to have all of the members of the council appointed by the governor serving at the pleasure of the governor, with the thought that the governor is, it's a cabinet level position, and it, the governor is responsible for this regional agency that is addressing major systems in the metropolitan area.
Ms. Dyson, I see we have a question. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So last year I had a bill that I think might have been similar to the State Advisory Council. Do you recall like what the council was comprised of, what sorts of people served on it in 93?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein, do you mean who were the council members?
Yes.
Met council members?
No. Who served on the State Advisory Council?
Oh, and the
council?
Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein, the co-chairs were legislators. Representative Myron Orfield and State Senator Carol Flynn were the co-chairs of the State Advisory Council. The there were several other legislators on it. Then there were appointees of, I can get you the actual list. I remember that the governor appointed a number of people including a former Met Council chair, Jim Hetland, was on the advisory council. If I'm remembering right, John Boland might have been. He was at that point, had been the longest serving council chair. Wayne Popham was on it. He had been a former state senator and had been in the state legislature when it was created. There were some, I believe, some Met Council members on it and probably representatives of local government, but I'd have to go back and get the actual membership.
Madam Chair,
for the freshman, this is House Research at Work. She remembers 23 years ago who was on the committee. So, and Madam Chair, just one then last question, because I'm intrigued by this. Was this established by the legislature pass a bill to establish this, or did the governor or someone else just appoint it by the executive branch, or how was it established?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein, it was established in session law. It was pretty much right at the end of session. There had, like I said, in 93, there were probably 10 different bills restructuring the Metropolitan Council that had been heard. Several of them were for elected bodies. Several were to turn it more into a cog. Some were to just change who gets to make appointments to what, abolishing different levels of government. There were so many different proposals out that year that were all getting heard, and it was clear there wasn't enough agreement on any one of them to be enacted. And pretty much in the last days of session, the modeling it after the Airport Advisory Council from the dual track airport planning process, the Advisory Council on Metropolitan Governance was put together and put into an omnibus bill somewhere. And it was the financing for that, there was actually money appropriated for the body. And the first two meetings of that were two full-day retreats at another location with outside experts brought in to talk about their academic and practical expertise on regional government issues from around the country.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It really helps to have this in-depth history, I think, because, I mean, we appreciate how many people before us have struggled with this. So, all right, Ms. Dyson.
The upshot of the 94 reorganization was the abolition of the three subordinate agencies, merging operations into the Met Council, and then the council membership as we have it today. In 95, the Metropolitan Livable Communities Act was enacted to provide incentives for the type of development that those programs participate in. The Livable Communities Act is a volunteer program, but because the communities want the money, they participate, and it requires participation in the local housing incentives program in order to be eligible for the tax-based revitalization accounts and the livable communities demonstration accounts funds. In 1995, also, the big change in the Land Planning Act was to require require the Met Council to review and update the development guide and the system plans and look at the forecasts of population and economic development for the region, and then put together the statements that go to the local governments, and then the local governments are then required to review and update their comprehensive plans. And let's see what's next. In 1995, the council had a role in coordinating the solid waste handling in the metropolitan area. That was then moved to the state, now with the PCA. So the Met Council is no longer involved in solid waste management as it had been. And then in 2001, the legislature created the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government, and I believe in December that commission just met to hear the Met Council present its proposed budget right before that was adopted for calendar year 2017. And then the last biggest change in 2001 was the property tax levy for transit operations was replaced with MVEST and substantially changed financing for transit in the metropolitan area. Just quickly going to functions for the Metropolitan Council. I've talked about some of these along the way, but the two main areas for functions for the Met Council, there's the planning and coordination function, and then there's the operations function. Planning and coordination, you have the regional systems. These, when I say regional systems, this is a statutory term. Not everything is a system. Even in when we talk about water as a system, water is not a regional system under the statute. The Met Council has been directed by the legislature to look at water supply, but it is not a system. Systems are wastewater collection and treatment, the interceptors and the wastewater treatment plants in the metro area, the parks and open space system, and transportation, which, as I mentioned, includes aviation and airports.
Ms. Dyson, yeah. If I could pause you for a second. Representative Bernardi. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hate to make you go back, but in page 31, on slide 31, you talked about how the property tax levy eliminated for transit operations was, you know, we have one for a levy for capital operations.
Yes.
Now. Is that the same boundaries as it was for the operations back then, and is that what lives on today for our tax levy for, you know?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, I think Mr. Lee would be the best person to answer that. All of the information about transit financing and levies is something that I do not have the expertise to answer anymore. So if that's something that you want to know about now, I think that was going to be part of the presentation.
Sure. We'll wait, I think, till we hear from Mr. Lee. Great.
Okay.
Wait, we may have another question here. Okay, Representative Barr.
Yes, the question is, when you mentioned earlier, thank you, Madam Chair, when you mentioned earlier in 2001 that the Legislative Commission was formed, and then it sounds like they approved the budget for the Metropolitan Council, could you talk a little bit about that?
Ms. Dyson.
Who does that?
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative Barr, the Legislative Commission reviewed the budget, heard the presentation, and the Legislative Commission has authority to make recommendations or comments on the budget. It does not approve it.
Representative Barr?
Who does approve their budget?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair and Representative Barr, the Met Council approves its budget. It has, its levy authority is set in statute, and within the parameters that are set in statute for what it can do and its resources, it establishes its own budget.
Thank you.
Is there a follow-up? Okay. All right.
Okay.
And proceed.
I've already talked a fair amount about the regional systems planning and coordination and the development guide, but this has been a core part of the Met Council's purpose and duties since the beginning to adopt the Metropolitan Development Guide. And just to state briefly, right now that's what the Met Council is calling the Thrive MSP 2040, but it consists of policy statements, goals, standards, programs, and maps prescribing guides for the orderly and economical development, public and private, of the metropolitan area. It must recognize and encompass physical, social, and economic needs of the metropolitan area and those future developments which will have an impact on the entire area, including but not limited to such matters as land use, parks and open space, land needs, the necessity for and location of airports, highways, transit facilities, public hospitals, libraries, schools, and other public buildings. Local comprehensive planning and other. What I want to mention with regard to the transportation planning for function of this, I mentioned earlier that the Transportation Advisory Board, the TAB as it's called, gets a lot of discussion. The origin of the TAB, back in the early 70s, the federal transportation law required metropolitan areas to develop the metropolitan planning organizations. And in the Twin Cities area, the Met Council formed at the Transportation Advisory Board and between the Transportation Advisory Board membership and the Met Council became the MPO. In the and that required a designation by the governor, and the governor, Wendell Anderson at the time, designated the Met Council as the MPO by a letter to the federal officials in 1973 as required by the federal legislation. The legislature then enacted in 1974 the statute that confirmed that designation and provided the council the authority to do this. The so that's the origin of the TAB, and that has remained the structure for the MPO for the metropolitan area since that time. Going on with the functions, we have transit operations, which you'll hear more about from over time, and then today, and then wastewater collection and treatment. This is a really big part of the Met Council's structure and function. Wastewater, it's a wholesale provider. It's not the retailer. The local sewers from your house out to the street and the city stuff, that's one level, and your local cities may be levying or collecting fees related to their systems. The Met Council is the wholesale provider, the big interceptors and the wastewater treatment plants. They're providing that service for about 2.7 million, almost the entire population of the metropolitan area, in 108 communities. There are 8 wastewater treatment plants, over 600 miles of interceptors, 5,000 miles of local sewers then with the cities and towns in the area, and treating over 250 million gallons of sewage a day. Last session, the sewer availability charge by the Met Council was a topic of interest. I don't know if that will be coming back or not, but that is the connection charge that the Met Council charges the local units of government for new connections at the local level. And that is I know Metro Cities and the Met Council have a great interest in that if the legislature is going to be looking at that again.
Members better known as SAC charges, you may have heard people talking about those.
Yeah, Madam Chair, there's the SAC charge by the Met Council, and then I think many local governments also have the SAC charges at the local level. The Metro HRA I mentioned before, and then there is the pass-through funding, the right-of-way acquisition loan fund. This is was set up in 1982, and MnDOT, in constructing highways, it can't purchase right-of-way until a road is actually programmed for construction. But to preserve right-of-way for roads, the legislature authorized the Met Council to set up a loan fund. And it's a revolving loan fund that allows local units of government to borrow the money to buy the right-of-way for the roads that they're planning for. And as I said, it's a levy, except that the revolving loan fund apparently for the last several years is sufficient, and they have not been levying in recent years for that. But it has been a significant program for the local governments in the area. Parks and open space, the park system starting back in 74, when I looked at the Met Council's website, it sort of gives this big number from 74 to 2014, $626 million of grants from state general obligation bonds, regional bonds issued by the council, the Environmental Trust Fund, and legacy money have gone out to local units of government for the regional parks and open space programs. The thing to remember about regional parks and open space is that all of the parks and open space are owned by the local units of government. They are called implementing agencies in the statute, and they consist of the counties in the area, Minneapolis and St. Paul and Bloomington, and then the Three Rivers Park District. The Met Council doesn't own or operate parks. And then I think the last slide is a really big 100,000-foot level view. I thought I would just throw in one slide that shows sources and uses in big numbers from this is taken from the presentation by the Met Council in December on their budget. I'm not going to go into any of the budget stuff for the council, but I did want to just close by talking about some of the big themes that come up over again with the Met Council. And those are the themes are related to what's the right balance between local and regional government or state, what's the state's role. Another theme is what's the most efficient, equitable, and economical way for a region to function, whether it's with its operations or its planning. And then what are the right ways to assure accountability, and to whom are you being accountable? Is the council is governed by state statute. The governing body is established by the governor. It's working with local governments. And then there are the residents within the local governments. There are balances all throughout that the legislature and the agency are always looking at. So the question always is whether or not the governance is helping or hurting in any particular area, and does changing the governance, does that help accomplish what the goal is that the legislature is seeking to meet? And with that, I'm going to stop, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Good. Looks like we have a few. So Representative McDonald first.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Question for Ms. Dayson. When the city approves a permit for a business that has a request for maybe 15 sack fees, does the Met Council have the authority to supersede that and add on sack fees if they deem it necessary?
Ms. Dayson?
A sack charge?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, it's not a question of looking at it. I think that I need to get you more information about sack charges in general. There is a policy manual that lays out exactly how these are structured, and that might help explain how the sack charges are imposed, because they're tables. In some respects, one of the sack charge is going to the local unit of government. The local unit of government then has some leeway on how it handles it. Typically, they just pass it on. But I think I would, instead of trying to answer your question about them arbitrarily changing things, there's a table that they're following, and it's a policy that's been adopted by the council. There was I think in 2013, a process that put together the policies and guidelines that are in place now. But I'm not comfortable answering that question at this moment.
Madam Chairman.
Representative McDonald.
And then just lastly, and the reason I asked that question is there's an Irish pub that's trying to open down on 7th Street, not too far from XL, a gentleman I know. And he's not open yet due to the Met Council, so he says, because of the SAC fees that the Met Council said, well, your usage is changing from the previous owner of the building, and therefore they have delayed his project and cost him $20,000 more. So those are some of the things that I'm trying to help him out with. For some reason, he reached out to me. But needless to say, he said they superseded what the city of St. Paul granted his permit for usage of the building for his pub. So it's unfortunate he would have been opened up at the beginning of the Wilds season, and now because of the Met Council, according to his data, it's been delayed. So that's why I asked that question.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, those are the types of issues that were coming up at the end of last session in the legislation that was heard in government operations relating to the SAC charges. And there was at least one hearing with a lot of testimony, both by the business owners and the council, on how it works. And that's why I would prefer not to try and, in one sentence or quick response, tell you, how this works. But this is an ongoing issue.
Hopefully the committee will find solutions to those questions.
I'm going to go to Representative Petersburg next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Dyson. This last slide, I tend to be a numbers person, and so I'm used to seeing percentages and so forth, and quite often through rounding and estimating, we're off a percentage or two on the total. But in this particular slide, that sources only represents 91%. So we're about 9% off, which on a $1 billion budget is $100 million or so. Are we missing one line item or something?
Probably.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, I think there's a 9% one that
I wonder if that's local or city or something, county maybe.
Just a second. This is why I didn't really want to go into budget stuff.
And if you don't have it,
a budget person.
You certainly could get
you
a
could
slide.
Just drop the slide. But,
And Madam Chair, I mean, if that's something you can get to us later, that's fine. I don't want to take up a lot of time today. I just was curious.
Well, we have at least one more
Madam
question.
Chair, it is the local. It's missing.
Okay, did everyone get that? We're adding what, 9%? And that's a local source? Okay. Could be. Anyway. Could be.
I think budget is, there's... Like I said, this is a, well, it's not only a high level, but it's got an error, sorry. There's a great deal more detail that can go into the budget discussion. And maybe I should have stayed away from it entirely.
Okay. Thanks for your adventuresomeness there. we have Representative Hertas with a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's perhaps noteworthy that Representative McDonald would be interested in an Irish pub. But I wanted to comment on a similar situation in my legislative district. A previous restaurant that had closed and sat vacant for a number of years, and then a new restaurateur decided to reopen the establishment and went through the process and permitting process, and then as they put hundreds of thousands of dollars into making a new building, their permit also, occupancy permit, was being held up because of disagreement on the Met Council on what seems to be somewhat arbitrary of establishing a new sewer access charge. And I mean, the SAC charge was just that, it was an access charge. There's a great deal of variance between users in residential environments based on family size. From an engineering perspective, when you develop a project, you presume about 100 gallons of effluent per day per person or occupant, and that's generically averaged out at about 2.4 persons per household. So when you do a new plat or a new subdivision, you design it, you're designing that sewer access unit to accommodate about 240 gallons of effluent per home per year. So in the case of the restaurant, you would presume that it wouldn't be too much different than its previous use, yet the Met Council wanted 7 or 8 times the sewer access charge for this particular business. In the end, the city helped, and they argued successfully that it was the use hadn't changed, just the owner. But after sitting vacant for some time, apparently there was this rule change, and eventually it was resolved. But that's an area that legislatively, you know, we might want to consider getting involved with, because it's pretty hard to you're paying in your sewer bill based on your consumption anyway, how much goes down the drain. So the somewhat arbitrary thing to start charging more in a progressive way just based on who you might be, or because your business versus residential or industrial versus residential, is something that needs to be looked into.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair Runbuck. I was find it interesting that people get excited over sewers, and it's very enjoyable too, because I came from a city council, and our Department of Public Infrastructure always called themselves everyday heroes, because we use those systems every day and nobody really wants to think about it or talk about it usually. And SAC charges always get a little controversial because folks pay them up front, and then if there is a change in policy, as Representative Hertas mentioned, somebody later on may be paying a little bit more than the previous owner did. A lot of that has to do with our sewer system is having infrastructure upgrades and needs, just like our transportation system is, because it's aging and hasn't been upkept. So a lot of times those fees change because of that. But I wanted to quick ask Ms. Dyson example of, would an example of a local fee, that 9% you're talking about for sources, be the, let's say, cities are charged a fee for their sewer maintenance to that the Met Council charges them that they pay, and depending on inflow and infiltration issues, that charge can go up and down. So would example of a local source be that fee Met Council also charges cities for? I'm just trying to figure out an example for the local. If you have a better one, please, you know.
I mean, you know, maybe we don't want to get so bogged down in this, so we have time really to hear from the our fiscal guy.
Madam Chair, just quickly, Representative Joachim, anything to do with the wastewater system is going to be under that user fee segment of that, because the sewer system is entirely user fee financed, whether you're talking SAC or just user fees. The 8%, the property tax levy, for example, for the Met Council, there is some levy there that is for just Met Council planning functions, operation, the administration functions. It's a small segment of it, but and then so it's yeah.
Thank you. So, I'm just trying to figure out how to differentiate that. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Now we'll I think we've saved enough time for Mr. Lee, fiscal information. Mr. Burris.
Madam Chair, members, I'll actually be taking the next couple as Mr. Lee comes, and he'll then be delving into the transit as well. So to start, be talking some about transit and largely to focus on the Twin Cities metro area and a couple of background concepts. I had mentioned the County's Transit Improvement Board earlier, and that's one of the entities that's heavily involved in transitway development in the Twin Cities. It was first created in 2008 as part of a larger transportation finance package. That package had a number of different components to it around transportation funding. So the gas tax was increased, registration taxes were changed, and a couple of local option sales taxes were authorized. And one of those local option sales taxes resulted in the creation of the CTIP, the County's Transit Improvement Board. And it's a joint powers board of elected officials at the county level, county elected officials. Currently, there are five counties that are form CTIB. Dakota County is currently commencing withdrawal. That's a three-year time frame under the agreements that underpin CTIB's creation. There's also just recently, in the last few months, been some public discussion of CTIB's dissolution, and there are a couple of different options that have been laid out, and that will probably be subject of legislative interest and CTIB activity just in the next few months. So the essence of what the board does involves utilizing revenue from this local option sales tax. There are a couple of legislative requirements that are established in the authorizing legislation for CTIB around the dollars and the structure of the board. One of the key things is that the funds are for use on transit ways, and that's developing light rail transit, commuter rail, potentially bus rapid transit. The legislation doesn't say more specifically what kinds of capital investments would be undertaken. It just refers to transitway capital and operating generally, as well as parking lots. The legislation lays out a requirement of establishing a process for providing grants to other local units of government that are developing the transitways. It has a committee called GEARS that does the grant-making evaluation. It also has bonding authority. It utilized that in 2010 through Hennepin County. And there have been a couple of instances in past years where the funds of some portion of the tax revenue has been legislatively directed, as directing CTIB to provide grants to the Metropolitan Council for bus operating. But in general, the decision-making around transitway development funding has been made by the board. CTIB has a number of different policies, but a couple that are worth highlighting involve transitways and operating funds. So one of the policies of CTIB, and this isn't set in state law, the state law is silent on this, but CTIP is determined to support the operating cost after a transit way has been built at 50% of the net cost. CTIP has also established a sort of its definition, if you will, of transit ways. So it's not statutorily defined, but for the board, the focus for transit way development and funding has been light rail transit and commuter rail and some highway-based bus rapid transit. And kind of the converse, opposite side of that is limited to no funding for arterial or street-based bus rapid transit and no funding for bus operations. That's apart from the legislatively directed funds. Another transit entity or set of entities that had been mentioned earlier are the opt-outs. And the suburban transit providers provide, are among the transit operators in the Twin Cities, providing local service as well as some express bus service between suburban communities and the core business districts of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Part of their funding comes from a portion of the motor vehicle sales tax, and we'll be talking in a little bit about that motor vehicle sales tax as part of the finance structure. So the opt-outs receive a statutory minimum, and then over and above that receive what the Met Council calls the regionally allocated as an additional portion of motor vehicle sales tax dollars distributed across the opt-outs. So that's to the in the 2017 budget of the Met Council, that's about, that is $28 million in allocation budgeted. This might be hard to read, but kind of gives you a sense of the where the opt-outs are located.
Mr. Lee?
Madam Chair, members, I will try to briefly cover the metropolitan area transit finance components. The largest piece of funding for metro area transit operations comes from a portion of the motor vehicle sales tax. The motor vehicle sales tax is one of three major transportation taxes. The first two, the gas tax and the motor vehicle registration tax, or TAB fees, are constitutionally dedicated 100% for roads, whereas the motor vehicle sales tax is dedicated between highways and transit. And the actual constitutional language says not more than 60% for highways, and not less than 40% for transit. And the legislature has the ability through statute to work within those boundaries. However, since the enactment of the constitutional amendment, those have been how the dollars have been allocated. So currently, 60% for the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, which is dedicated towards the state trunk highway system, county state aid, municipal state aid street system. 36% for the Twin Cities Metropolitan Area Transit, and 4% for Greater Minnesota Transit. There's a little bit more detail on Greater Minnesota Transit. We thought for the Metropolitan Governance Committee that may be saved for another time. So we're just going to focus on metro area transit. Another source, as Ms. Dyson alluded to, the regional property tax levy that at one time funded transit operations in the metropolitan area. There's a small remainder when the operations piece was moved to the general fund and then to the motor vehicle sales tax that remained, that was used to pay back bonds to buy new buses. That levy still exists and is about $45 million a year spread across the metropolitan area, and it's known as the Regional Transit Capital Levy. And there's the question earlier about the area in which it's imposed, and if you go to the next slide, there's a map, and you can see from the earlier map of the suburban transit providers, this is the entire transit taxing district. And I believe since the change in 2001, when the operations moved off of the property tax levy, that a few communities have been added to the capital levy. I will double check on this for the committee, but I believe those were Lakeville and Forest Lake. So moving on, this property tax levy is used, allocated by the council, and it is used primarily to maintain and replace the bus fleet and some capital maintenance type activities for the Metropolitan Council. But by and large, it's not used for major new transitway projects. And the way the Metropolitan Council has been allocating it has been used as matching funds for federal dollars for bus replacements. And some kind of broad concepts to think about in terms of transit finance, the operating side being the day-in, day-out, delivering transit service, planning for transit operations kind of on a day-to-day basis, and the capital side, meaning the capital maintenance type activities, but also major transitway development and system expansion. And just note the distinction in the two in that the motor vehicle sales tax general fund allocations for the Metropolitan Council have typically only been allocated for transit operations, whereas the general obligation bonding county's Transit Improvement Board and Regional Rail Authority spending typically is on the capital side, with the exception of the CTIP funding for 50% of the transitway operating subsidy, kind of going from the sales tax for operating.
Mr. Lee, we have a question. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Bures. Is that how you say your last name? Or oh, I'm sorry, Andy's last name.
Lee.
Mr. Lee. Sorry, I had my gentleman confused. Earlier, Ms. Dyson had mentioned that the Metropolitan Council presents and approves their own budget. Can you tell me, on the prior slide, you had said that bonds were issued by the Metropolitan Council under legislative authorizations. What exactly does that mean?
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair and Representative Barr, the legislature authorizes the levy. Okay. And then the council goes out and executes that levy and borrows borrows for the amount that would be supported by that levy, if that makes sense.
Okay. May I add another question?
Representative Barr?
Okay, Madam Chair. And is that done annually, or excuse me, per biennium, or how often is that?
Mr. Lee?
Madam Chair and Representative Barr, in various tax bills and also in transportation bills, language around that has been authorized, I believe, annually.
Okay. All right.
And I Madam Chair and Representative Barr, I should note a provision about the regional transit levy was included in the tax bill that was passed by the legislature in 2016, but was pocket vetoed by the governor.
All right. Thank you. Who's next now? It looks like Mr. Burris is stepping up again.
Oh, Madam Chair, if I might just add on, Representative Barr, I believe the last authorization actually covered two different years, but historically it had been an annual authorization, and you know, it's up to the legislature whether to go, if authorizing at all, whether to go with 1 year or multiple years, and you know, that might depend to some extent on what request the Metropolitan Council comes forward with.
Very good. We're close to reaching our deadline here, so I bet we'll make it.
So very briefly, going through the sources of operating. Federal aid can be used for operating. Federal aid is distributed at on a formula basis, and I'm referring to federal aid for operating and not for big capital programs. But the major state sources are the state general fund appropriation, the motor vehicle sales tax allocation, which is a statutory allocation. So the general fund allocation tends to be authorized every biennium in a transportation bill, whereas the motor vehicle sales tax allocation is a statutory appropriation to the council that does not need to be in those transportation bills. And, of course, fare box revenue. And jumping back to the county's transit improvement sales tax, again, this is used largely for capital needs. CTIP has had a policy of trying to cover 30% of capital costs of its transitway projects and then relying on the federal share for 50%, a state share of 10%, and a regional rail authority, that's a county property tax levy, for the other 10%. Go to the next one. And this is a slide showing the mix between the motor vehicle sales tax, the general fund, in the past few years. And you'll note a few places where you see the county spends improvement board funding. When the authorization for the tax was enacted in the 2008 transportation legislation, the first $29 million of those sales tax proceeds went to transit operations and, in fact, to backfill a hole in bus operations. And again, in the 2012-2013 biennium, there was a budget deficit and there was a reduction in state support for transit operations. And so there was statute requiring CTIB to pay a higher share of transit operations for that biennium. And not included in this chart is the amount that CTIB has an agreement with the Metropolitan Council to pay for the 50% operating subsidy of the transit waste that it builds. So things like Central Corridor or North Star, although North Star was before CTIB. And then this just sort of lays out in a more graphic format the mix of funds between Greater Minnesota Transit, the general fund, the motor vehicle sales tax, and you can see the lease tax at $33 million, and that only goes for Greater Minnesota Transit.
So, Mr. Lee, back to number 47. So the total $708 million is for the operating costs of everything that's operating, the buses, light rail, North Star. That's the whole ball of wax there, $708 million.
Madam Chair and members, this would just be the state portion of that cost for those 2 years. So in addition to that, there's fares and CTIB dollars for the 50% operating share. And I can get you the dollar for the total amount. I have it handy here somewhere, but not immediately.
Appreciate that. Thanks.
And moving on, the general fund and motor vehicle sales tax money that goes into the Metropolitan Council, as we discussed earlier, is allocated by the council rather than the legislature. So the council determines with these state resources what to put the money towards. It's not historically been something that the legislature has stipulated X many dollars for such and such program or function. And this is just within the transit area, with a few exceptions in that some general fund dollars in past biennium have had rider languages for specific projects or programs. But the vast bulk of the general fund and motor vehicle sales tax dollars is allocated by the council rather than the legislature. And this pie chart is to give you a sense of the just the transit transportation division of the Metropolitan Council, the sources, and on the next slide, you will see the sources for the Metropolitan Council's six-year capital plan. You can see a large share of that is federal. This relates to the large transitway projects. And then a smaller share for CTIB. And though CTIB has a policy of participating 30% in those costs, this chart also shows regional bonds, which are the RTC-backed property tax bonds, mostly for bus system replacement. So this includes both the large transit projects and the more day-to-day capital maintenance type capital work. And again, this I won't go through in too much detail. This is just the breakout in spending between the various modes. And on the last slide, a breakout of the various capital projects.
Very good. I think we're fully informed. So, and the time having reached 2:45, I think we are finished. So thank you very, very much to our presenters. Very useful, helpful information and members. That concludes our agenda for today. Were there any questions? I mean, we can take a moment. Okay. All right. I think we're adjourned.